From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, dance, from classic Hollywood musicals to hip-hop. First, we talk with film director Stanley Donen. He co-directed On the Town and Singin' in the Rain with the late Gene Kelly. Donen directed Fred Astaire in Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Then we meet a dancer from the off-Broadway hip-hop review Jam on the Groove. Adesola Okasolumi, also known as Dee Incredible, has been popping and locking since the early 80s. And linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on William Safire's use of the expression congenital liar to describe Hillary Clinton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. AT&T says it's prepared to move into the local phone service market now that the new telecommunications legislation has been signed. The new legislation allows long-distance companies to enter the $90 billion a year local calling business. President Clinton praised the law today at a signing ceremony in Washington, especially the part calling on TV manufacturers to install the so-called V-chip to let parents block violent TV programs.
Of course, parents now have to do their end of the job and decide what they do or don't want their young children to see. But if every parent uses this chip wisely, it can become a powerful voice against teen violence, teen pregnancy, teen drug use, and for both learning and entertainment. The responsibility of parents to do this is something they deserve and something they plainly need. Now that they have it, they must use it.
Even as the president signed the bill, civil libertarians went to federal court to block it. They say a provision that bans indecent speech on computer networks amounts to censorship. Social Security recipients won't have to worry about getting their check next month, even if Congress and the White House remain deadlocked on the budget. President Clinton today signed legislation guaranteeing that Social Security payments will be made in March. Disturbed by the rise of millionaire presidential candidate Steve Forbes, two senators are calling for a constitutional amendment that would allow Congress to limit the amount of personal money that can be spent in political campaigns. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
More than 20 years ago, the Supreme Court declared that a candidate can spend an unlimited amount of money to run for office because that's protected political speech. Republican Arlen Specter and Democrat Ernest Hollings want Congress and the voters to overturn that ruling, amending the Constitution to give Congress control over all election spending, including personal funds. This is hardly a new issue, but Hollings says the rapid rise of Steve Forbes gives it a new urgency.
We see it now with the Forbes candidacy, and the last 3 months, I think, you folks reported $14 million in a three-month period. Look, our hope is to have elections, not auctions.
Specter says it's not inconceivable that Forbes could buy the White House. But so far, voters don't seem concerned by Forbes' wealth, and Republicans in Congress have long opposed limiting personal campaign spending. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
Officials at Apple Computers have broken their silence on speculation the firm might merge with Sun Microsystems. Apple today denied it is involved in merger talks with anyone. There had been reports this month that Sun Microsystems was negotiating a takeover deal with Apple. Apple said rumors about the possible deal have hurt earnings. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up this hour more than 9 points at 5501.88 on volume of 357 million shares. You're listening to NPR News. Oregon residents haven't seen flooding like this in 30 years. Almost all the rivers and streams in the state are near or above flood stage, and it's still raining. Flooding is also reported in Washington State and Idaho. More than 750,000 people in New Jersey still have no clean tap water, one day after a huge water main break. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
A state of emergency remains in effect in parts of northern New Jersey more than 24 hours after two major underground pipes burst in New Milford, flooding local streets on an icy morning. Today, roughly one of every 10 residents in the entire state had to go to work without washing the dishes or taking a shower. They either have no water at all or else are turning on the taps to discover a brown, muddy substance. Customers of the United Water Company who do have water pressure are being warned to boil the water before drinking it. Repair crews worked through the night and managed to fix the smaller of two broken pipes, but utility officials say they've run into problems fixing the other water main, and they're just not sure how long it will take to repair it. I'm Steve Inskeep reporting.
According to published reports, the federal government will take another look at whether tobacco companies deliberately misled the public about the dangers of smoking. The Wall Street Journal says federal prosecutors will look into studies by the Council for Tobacco Research. Russia's defense minister today called on the Bosnian government to free a Serb general held on suspicion of war crimes. Pavel Grachov told reporters on arrival in Belgrade that the detained officer is not on a list of suspects drawn up by the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. Grachov said the Bosnian Serbs expressed their concern about the seizures of at least 8 Serb soldiers over the past 3 weeks. The government today reported a slowdown in the growth of productivity during the third quarter. According to the Labor Department, non-farm productivity rose at an annual rate of just 1.4%, less than half the rate of the previous quarter. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The co-director of Singin' in the Rain, Stanley Donen, will be honored this evening by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. In a moment, Donen will tell us about filming this scene.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feel, and I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain.
Gene Kelly, who died last week, gave Stanley Donen his big break. Kelly chose Donen to be his assistant in a Broadway production of Best Foot Forward. Soon after, when they were both in Hollywood, Kelly brought the 19-year-old Donen to Columbia Pictures to work on CoverGirl, the movie that made Kelly a star. Kelly and Donen went on to co-direct On the Town, It's Always Fair Weather, and Singin' in the Rain. Donen directed Fred Astaire in Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Donen's other films include Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, The Pajama Game, Damn Yankees, Charade, Two for the Road, and Bedazzled. A new biography of the director has just been published called Dancing on the Ceiling. I asked Donen about the rain and the puddles in his most famous production number.
People believe these things happen spontaneously. Certainly dance numbers are anything but spontaneous. They're worked out in great detail over quite a long period of time. And so we decided where, how, what he would dance, how he would dance, how quickly he would dance, what the steps were, where he would be. We rehearsed on the street and so on, and we said, he'll splash in a puddle here. Well, there had to be a puddle there, so we had to chop out the cement and make a little hole, and then it would fill up with water, and he would splash in that puddle there. And since dance is very specific, and when you do it the same way every time, you end up in the same spot, we placed the puddles where they were necessary.
Now, where did the rain come from?
Pipes. It came from the Culver City water supply. Pipes overhead feeding the rain.
Did you make the temperature of the water warm so that Gene Kelly's muscles wouldn't be a problem?
No, yeah. On the contrary. It was so hot in there. It would have been nice if the water had been cool. We were in midsummer, and we were under black canvas, so in the bright daylight. We didn't shoot it at night in real night. And the sun beating down on a black canvas overhead with the water pouring down on it was like a sauna in there.
Hmm.
It would have been better to have refrigerated water in that case.
Now, you work with Gene Kelly. You also work with Fred Astaire on the films Royal Wedding and Funny Face. Now, did you have a different approach to shooting each of them since their approach to dance was different?
Yes.
Could you describe the difference in shooting them?
Well, because Gene's movements are basically athletic, and the force of the movement is important to get the thrill of watching him dance, it's harder to produce that on film because film is not able to get forceful movement because it's only a two-dimensional medium. And you need two eyes to see sharp, hard, forward and back or sideways movement. You need three dimensions. And therefore, I tried to make up for that lack in the way I photographed it, which meant trying to make it a more dynamic move by the placement or movement of the camera or lack of movement of the camera. With Fred, you want to get the delicacy of the movement. So it's another way of focusing the eye in this two-dimensional medium on his physical, you know, subtle movements.
There's a dance scene I want you to talk about that's very mysterious when you see it. It's the dancing on the ceiling sequence, the sequence that your biography is named after. This is a Fred Astaire dance number from
Royal Wedding.
Yeah, from Royal Wedding. So, he dances on the floor and the walls and the ceiling on this. What did you do to create that illusion?
We had to build a room inside a wheel or a barrel, if you like, which turned slowly and in which the camera turned with the room as well as the lights and everything in the room. And its turning had to be so controlled and gentle, both in timing and in movement, that the things didn't shake or didn't throw Fred Astaire around, and the camera had to be fixed to its position so it turned exactly as the room did, and so did the lights. Otherwise, you would see the room turning. As the lights stayed still, you'd see shadows moving and so on. And then the wall, if we were now going to Fred dancing from the floor to the side wall, slowly the side wall becomes the floor, and he's actually dancing on that floor, which is now the wall of the room. But since the camera turns with it, the camera doesn't know that the set has moved in that sense. It doesn't see outside the room, so to the camera, it's still the side wall, and it looks like Fred has actually gone to the side wall. And that's repeated on the ceiling, the other side, and so on.
So did the choreography have to be done in such a way as to coincide with the turning of the room?
Yes, and the turning of the room had to coincide with the choreography and so on. They had to marry each other. And that only could happen with trial and error.
You say in your biography that the most difficult part in a film musical is making that transition from talking into dancing or talking into singing. And I could see how that would be the most difficult the most difficult part. What are some of the ways you've gotten around that in production numbers to try to make a smooth transition?
Well, we try any number of ways in the number we were just talking about in All the World to Me is the name of the song where he dances around the room. You hear him singing, but actually his lips aren't moving in the beginning. So it's almost as though his singing is an underscoring of the scene. And then after the verse of the song, he starts theoretically singing it with his mouth. So that's one technique. There are numbers of ways I've tried to do it. I've tried it sometimes with the characters back to the camera. You hear him singing, but you don't see him singing. Sometimes in Singing in the Rain, we had a little vamp which was written, which sort of eased him from dialogue into song. The vamp ahead of the song was written by Roger Edens. Most people are familiar with it. It goes do 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 do. That little vamp. He sings that, and that seems to bridge the moment.
Yeah, and in Moses Supposes, they start.
In Moses Supposes, they're talking the lyric. That's right, and then the music joins the talk. So there are, I hope, endless ways of avoiding a catastrophe at that moment.
Yeah, well, what goes wrong if that transition isn't done just right? Do you think the audience thinks it looks
people
foolish?
Laugh mm-hmm. is what goes wrong. They think this is highly unlikely. People don't sing in this situation, they think. Why are they doing that? It seems not real, not acceptable, and it makes the audience uncomfortable and they laugh.
Now, when you worked at MGM, or at least I think most of the time you were at MGM, Louis B. Mayer was the head of the studio.
Not really.
Just part of the time?
Well, by the time we did Singing in the Rain, Dori Shary was there running the studio. Mayer was still there, but the decisions were made by Dori Shary.
Wow. What was Mayer like to work with?
I knew him very slightly. He was clearly... he had a large input into what kind of films were made. He was someone who, I think if he were alive today, he couldn't bear it. He would have lost his mind because he wanted films to only be sweet and gentle and talk about mothers loving sons and daughters and family things. He loved, for example, the Andy Hardy series, which showed the kind of family life, the only kind of family life he really liked to see. He didn't like to see, for example, women in slacks. It drove him mad. He thought it's not feminine for a woman to wear pants. I remember there was a great problem, as I was told, about Katharine Hepburn, who wore pants in some MGM movies. He didn't like that. He had a lot of things which found their way into the whole studio output. He didn't like shiny surfaces for some reason.
Shiny
on
surfaces?
Film. Yes, he didn't like things reflecting.
Uh-huh.
So MGM films, unless you fought very hard, had a very soft look to them. He didn't like dark shadows, so MGM black and white films had filled in light in the shadow areas. There were all kinds of odd things.
Did you ever want to do something that was either bleaker or... where the lighting was darker or the mood sexier than Louis B. Mayer wanted?
Well, I think I can't think of a specific instance, but we always tried to make the lighting look... L.B. Mayer's idea of lighting was not, from my point of view, didn't have any dynamic quality to it. It was too bland. So we fought to do that, but... I can't give you an example of off the top of my head.
Now, what was the process of fighting like? Would you go into his office and,
make your case? No, or? It was all done through... He was way above all that. It was... These things had become law at the studio in a funny way, unwritten, albeit. But, you know, there are all kinds of departments. The wardrobe department said, Mr. Mayer won't like this, so the... camera department said, Mr. Mayer won't like this, or the set, the art department, Mr. Mayer won't like it like that. And you have to find a way to get around that, whatever that might be. Using the star power or your producer or being adamant yourself and saying, well, we're going to do it like this and I don't care what he likes. However you got around it. But his presence physically was not, he never confronted these issues with the people involved.
Stanley Donen is my guest, and he directed Singing in the Rain, Funny Face, On the Town, Charade, and he has a new biography called Dancing on the Ceiling. He's also getting honored tonight by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. Back with film director Stanley Donen. Now, I want to ask you about your musical Funny Face, which starred Fred Astaire as a fashion photographer and Audrey Hepburn as a young woman who is kind of bullied into becoming a fashion model.
Antagonistic to fashion.
Yes, yes. And she really wants to be a kind of beatnik. And anyways, they, of course, fall in love, you know, Hepburn and Fred Astaire, although he's really much older than she is, which isn't spoken about in the film. But how are they paired together, Esther and Hepburn?
By our casting? Well, who are the best people to play these parts? Fred Astaire and Audrey Hepburn, and lo and behold, we got them. That was the unbelievable part of it. We got Audrey Hepburn after a great deal of trouble, because when we sent her the script, she said yes, she would like to be in the movie, but we prepared the script at MGM. MGM couldn't get, she was under contract to Paramount, and MGM could not get Paramount to lend Audrey Hepburn's services to MGM to make Funny Face. So the picture looked like it was a dead issue when it occurred to me and Roger Edens to see if we could get Paramount to buy the picture and take us to Paramount to make the picture. They had Audrey. So we went to MGM and said, can we try to get Paramount to buy this situation from you? And the studio said, well, if they'll pay us enough money, yes. Although they were going to lose it all. Nevertheless, Paramount paid them and borrowed Roger Edens and me to go to Paramount to make the picture. That way we got Audrey Hepburn. Once we had the picture at Paramount, we asked Fred Astaire, would he like to make this picture with Audrey Hepburn and us? And Roger knew him well, and I had directed him previously in Royal Wedding. And he said he'd love to. So that's how we got them together.
No, Audrey Hepburn, who wrote the introduction to your biography, says that she was so nervous about dancing with Astaire, she actually lost her breakfast. She threw up the morning of the first performance together. Were you aware of how nervous she was?
Yes. It is terrifying to work with Fred Astaire, particularly if you're a dancer, as Audrey Hepburn was a very trained dancer. So Fred Astaire was everyone's idol, and suddenly she's thrust into being his equal. Of course, it's terrifying for her.
And was he
very gentle, very helpful? He had been through this with other people that were equally terrified of working with him. But he loved Audrey, as everyone did.
Now, another movie I want to ask you about is On the Town. Three guys on leave in New York. And some of this numbers are actually shot in the streets of New York, which you've pointed out. This isn't the first time that production numbers were shot on location, but it was still unusual. In fact, I think you had to fight to shoot the movie in New York instead of on the set in Hollywood.
That's right. That is right. Yes, we had to fight very hard. We didn't shoot as much as we wanted to shoot in New York, but we did get a bit of the movie done in New York.
What were you up against in New York, since the city was probably not used to movies being shot on the streets?
No, the city was not used to it, and certainly wasn't used to Frank Sinatra in a sailor suit singing on the street. So we had problems of crowd control or hiding a camera or trying to get the shot without the people realizing what was going on, or we had to use many different ways of getting it done. And the actual city of New York was very helpful to us. They wanted the picture to be photographed on the streets, but the thing of traffic and noise and onlookers staring at him and staring at the camera or hearing the playback, and all of that caused great difficulties.
Now, there were three leads, three male leads, Frank Sinatra, Gene Kelly, and Jules Munson, yeah. And he apparently was afraid of heights.
And he was terrified of heights.
And where was the production number on top of a building?
There were several. There was one on top of the RCA building. But it turned out he was even afraid when we got to New York to shoot. He said, can my room be on the ground floor? I don't even want to be one floor up. He was absolutely thrown into a catatonic state at height. And there was nothing for it but to try to get it done. And I must say that he was extremely brave, because knowing what kind of fear he had, he managed to go and stand up on a roof high in New York, and and sing and move and not show his fear. Whereas when we would go to the roof to do the scene, he would actually ride in the elevator on his hands and knees. It sounds funny, but it's terrifying. Somebody who has that kind of phobia is in a terrible sweat, and that he was able to overcome it is a tremendous courage.
Did you know that he was afraid of heights when you cast him?
Not when I cast him, it never occurred to me. No, none of us were aware of it till we got on the plane and wanted to come to New York. I didn't fly with him, so I don't know what he was like in an airplane. But certainly when he got to New York, he said, "I can't go up in the elevator." But he did.
Well, you must have had a sinking feeling in your stomach. I mean, you had the production numbers planned already.
Yes, well, we did the best we can. We sometimes put Jules Munchen between Sinatra and Kelly so he would feel somewhat supported by them in these high spots. But the whole sequence wasn't done up on the rooftops. Some of it was done in Central Park and Rockefeller Center and Fifth Avenue and Chinatown, Little Italy, all over New York. The Brooklyn Navy Yard, there were all kinds of places where he wasn't in mortal fear.
Now, how did Sinatra and Kelly get along?
They got along great. They were great friends from before that. We had done, this was the third picture that Kelly, Sinatra, and I had worked on together. So they were great buddies and remained so until Gene died.
But Sinatra was hard to work with, right?
I wouldn't categorize him as hard to work with. He was very willing to do what you wanted him to do. He just had certain feelings of he wanted to go to lunch when he went to lunch, or he wanted to not rehearse as much as perhaps we would. But he managed to force himself to do what we wanted. Gene was terrific there because he admired Gene so much. So it was... wasn't all that hard.
Director Stanley Donen, he's the subject of a new biography called Dancing on the Ceiling. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
We've got one day here and not another minute. See the famous sights.
We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it beneath the Broadway lights.
But we've hair on our chests, so what we like the best for the nights.
New York, New York, a wonderful town. The Bronx is up and the battery's down. The people ride in a hole in the ground. New York, New York, it's a wonderful town.
Famous places to visit are so many, so the guidebooks say.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jam on the Groove. We talk with dancer Adesola Osakolumi, also known as The Incredible, who's now performing off-Broadway in a hip-hop review. And linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on William Safire's use of the phrase congenital liar to describe Hillary Clinton. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jam on the Groove is a hip-hop review nearing the end of an off-Broadway run that will tour in the fall. My guest is one of the dancers, Adesola Osokolumi, also known as D Incredible. He grew up in the Bronx, where he learned the moves from some of the pioneers of breakdancing in the early 80s. He was a founding member of the Rhythm Technicians, which recently teamed up with other dancers, including members of the Rock Steady Crew and Magnificent Force, to form the company Get Original Productions. He started dancing in jams at schoolyards and clubs, but he's since danced around the world, as well as at the Kennedy Center, Lincoln Center, and on music videos. I asked Osokolumi to describe the basic moves of hip-hop dancing.
We have b-boying, which most people know as breakdancing. Breakdancing was a term that we never started. It was more of a media terminology. B-boying is the breaking of what's done on the floor. And a quick definition of the B, a B refers to the break of a record, which is, you know, the percussive part of the record that the DJs would spin back and forth, extending it. And to that part of the music, the guys would go down on the floor. So you have b-boying, you know, the footwork, the head spins, the back spins, all the physical moves. You have popping, which is a form that began in the West Coast. Popping is basically muscle contraction and release. Contracting your muscles, releasing your muscles, incorporates a lot of illusions, waves, the moonwalk, which people are very familiar with. But the moonwalk is just one move in a series of moves called floats. You have forward moonwalk, you have a backward moonwalk, you have a side moonwalk, etc. And then you have locking. Locking consists of wrist rolls, points. Some people make the similarity or make the comparison to jazz. They even call it super jazz. It's a very character-filled dance form with a lot of energy. So you basically have popping, locking, and b-boying. Those three forms.
My impression is that not many people are breakdancing or, you know, doing this kind of hip-hop dancing anymore, that it was much more popular in the late 70s and early 80s than it is now. Is that true?
To an extent, yes, but I think on a larger level, no. I'll deal with America first. When breaking and popping and locking were in its commercial heyday, of course, everyone did it. You saw it everywhere. It became a media event. You saw commercials. I mean,
exactly. They were doing it on
right,
hamburger commercials,
right,
as well
exactly,
as on the street. Yeah.
I mean, I did a Levi's 501 jeans commercial myself. But what did happen was you had a lot of choreographers and a lot of dancers, a lot of pop artists who saw the dance had energy, who saw it was something new. We feel it was something that came along to nurture the dance world. So maybe you didn't see the movements done in their full form, but many dancers, many choreographers incorporated elements of what we do in their videos. I mean, from, you know, Paula Abdul to Michael Jackson to Janet Jackson. Now, in America, it's become a part of dance. I mean, we've been in dance classes and dance studios, working with people, you know, checking stuff out, and people always are asking, how do you do that? How can we incorporate that into what we do?
Now tell me, this might be a misperception, but
okay.
it seems to me that earlier in rap, that rap groups would often have dancers with them, and then that maybe when gangster rap came along, that association ended a little bit, and that the gangster rapper's attitude wasn't about dancing.
I think that's basically true. Again, when hip-hop first began, you had four basic elements, the four main elements that formed hip-hop culture. You had the dancing, you had the MC on the mic, which we call them MCs, not rappers, but, you know, the term is, the meaning is still the same, the person who was verbally exciting the crowd. You had the DJ. His responsibility was to set the musical undertone, the musical backbone, and you had the graffiti artist. When rap first started, when hip-hop first started, at jams, outdoor block parties and stuff, you had the DJ, you had the MC, and then you had the dancers in front. The MC's job was like, he was like the storyteller, the modern day poet who got the dancers hyped. Then the dancers came on and were on equal footing with the MC. As the music industry got involved, it became more of a money-making thing. Definitely, you had the rappers being put to the forefront, the dancers being put to the back. Now, as far as gangster rap goes, of course, all rap and all MCing is storytelling. So a lot of the stories that the gangster rappers are telling don't necessitate dance. because they're not really talking about things that are happy and dance-oriented. So by virtue of that, you definitely see less dancers as the industry has sort of embraced gangster rap. And by embraced, I mean not that people love it or agree with it, but in terms of it being the most popular, bringing in the most revenue, it definitely has been embraced.
Now, do you remember the first time that you saw breakdancing and popping and locking?
Yep. Yeah. I had a friend of mine named Charlie Beats, as he's now known. He's in the music business. You know, the area in the Bronx I lived in was sort of like a hotbed for popping and locking. A lot of great poppers and a lot of great dancers were in that area. So it wasn't like you had to go search for it. You look out your window in the summer, you see somebody on the corner just, you know, hanging out in the schoolyard, just working out with a box, just practicing. So I saw my friend Charles doing a wave. And I was like, yo, Charles, what was that? You got it. I was fascinated. It was something I'd never seen before. It was like magical. It was like I had seen magic. And from that point on, I was attracted to it. Now, before I saw it live, definitely I saw it on Soul Train and saw other dancers who were doing it long before. But seeing it live was just, it took it to another level. It made it tangible because it was right there in front of me.
So how did you start to learn this? Did you get anybody to teach you? Did you just work on it yourself?
Okay. Well, like I said, I saw a lot of people doing it, and it was a matter of, at first, learning from watching people, trying to pick up what they did, because when I first started in the area I started in, if you weren't that good, it was difficult to get people to work with you. It was almost like being an apprentice and saying, excuse me, can you teach me? Like, nah, get out of here, you know, come back in, I don't know, you got to come back and show me something better. So initially, it was kind of difficult getting people to show me because they only wanted to, I guess, work with people who were, you know, pretty good. But I continued trying to get better and better. Then I had another friend named Rodney, an incredible dancer, incredible popper and locker, and his brother Chris. And they actually, you know, would begin to show me certain moves. This is how you do a wave. This is how you do a hit. This is how we create movement, blah, 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 blah. And at that point, once I started, you know, actually having stuff explained to me, it became much easier, obviously.
Now, what about the stuff that always looks the most difficult, like spinning on your head and spinning on your back? How'd you learn that stuff?
Well, see, that's a good question, because primarily I'm more of a popper and locker. I do some floor movement, but I'm not a b-boy. But I will tell you, from speaking to b-boys that I know and people I work very closely with, like Ken Swift, like Quickstep, like Legs, a lot of b-boys in our company, first of all, everything that we do involves an incredible amount of practice and determination because, again, there's no formal school for it. So a lot of it is a person's really personal drive. As far as spinning on your head goes, I know I've spoken to people, and it is something that you work up to in small increments. It is not easy. You first have to know how to balance on your head and then tap, just do a few taps and go around, and it takes a lot of hard work, and it takes a lot of courage, because
yeah,
getting on your head and attempting to spin even for a quarter of a revolution is frightening. And yes, it can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing, but hopefully anyone who wants to spin on their head would have someone who's breaking it down for them, showing them what to do, what not to do, where their body should be placed. It's almost like a reverse pirouette when you're on your toe and you're lifting up. Mm-hmm. If you can think of being on your head and lifting up against gravity, it's deep.
How do you create a combination of moves?
In popping and locking especially, you always take a move, let's take a basic move, and then you try to build on it, which is how you create your combinations, which is how you create your big battle moves or your big showstopper moves. Let's say you're just taking a wave, right? I'm throwing a wave from my right hand up, you know, through my shoulder, roll it around my chest, and throw it out my left hand. Okay, that's a wave. Okay, I got a wave now. So, well, I need to do something different. Okay, maybe now, rather than throwing from right hand to left hand, I'll throw it to my right hand. When it gets to my shoulder, I'll put it in my chest, and then I'll hit, pop. I'll pop it there. Then I'll break it down, and a fast wave, a body wave, down into my foot, and hit again when it gets to my leg. So now the visual has gone from my arm to chest, down to my body, down to my foot. Then I'll take my right hand. Now I want to move the wave, but with my foot. So I'll take my right hand and do heel toe, move my heel with the hand. Like the hand is controlling the toe, almost like a marionette. Move it out, bow, hit it, move it back to where it originally started, then bring it back up through my body and then out through my left hand. So rather than throw it from right to left, I took it from right into chest, hit, waved it down to my foot, hit again, made it wiggle to the right, wiggled it back to the beginning position, waved it back up the body from the foot, through the hips, through the stomach, through the chest, out through the left arm, boom, and hit it out again. So rather than just take a wave and go right to left, I took it from like A to B, and I added C, D, E, F, G along the line, and that's how I create combinations.
My guest is Adesola Osakalumi, one of the dancers in the off-Broadway hip-hop revue Jam on the Groove. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Adesola Osakalumi, we're talking about hip-hop dancing. When you started getting your moves down, mm-hmm. what kind of places would you dance? Clubs, schoolyards? What were the different options for you?
Okay. The different options that existed were definitely schoolyards. You know, this was a dance that was a communal. You go out, and if there was a jam was a big outdoor party, be it in a schoolyard, be it in a park, be it in a community room. Definitely at clubs, definitely at house parties. House parties was where a lot of things happened. Clubs also. Personally, when I first started dancing and learning this dance, I was in high school. I was in a private high school. So I was like, as we say, under lock and key. I wasn't allowed really to go out to clubs. So initially, clubs were not even a possibility for me. I did most of my like development and practicing in my room. That might sound funny, but I did a lot of stuff in my room to the extent my mom be like, look, knock, knock, knock. Stop. Will you stop that? Turn the music down. It was that type of thing. Now, when I got out of high school and got into college, then I became party man. I went out a lot. I went out a lot because one thing about going out to clubs, as any dancer will tell you, you know, if you dance just in your room or just with your boys around your block or around your neighborhood, you will get good, but you'll be limited because you won't see a diversity. You won't see a wide range. So after a while, you begin seeing the same movement, same people, and it can become a little limiting. But going out to clubs, you see people from Brooklyn with their moves and Queens and their style. You see people who dance differently, have different body forms, and that's when you really start learning because that's when your reputation is on the line nightly when you're in a club.
In the early days, was dancing for you very competitive? Were there different groups that would compete with each other?
Oh, duh. Definitely. Again, this dance is very competitive. That's where I think you saw the energy. What people mistook as violence was just competitive energy. It was like football. It was like musical football without teams. Just one person going against another person. When I was starting out, again, I did a lot of stuff by myself, but there were definitely crews and there were definitely battles. The best thing, the most exciting thing was either going to a party and knowing so-and-so is going to battle so-and-so because he thinks he's better, or this group is going to battle this group. And that was definitely how a reality, a fact of life, battles.
What was a battle like and who decided who won?
Okay. Good. Okay. A battle could happen, first of all, at any time or any place where you had two dancers. Someone, let's say you're in a club, right? Say back in the days, people were at the Roxy. A guy's dancing. And he's, you know, doing his thing. And maybe he did a move that he really liked. And he's smiling. He's like, yeah, that was fresh. I killed it. That was dope. That was all that, right? Another person might say, who does he think he is? I'm going to go battle him. The person, you could just walk up to a person and say, yo, what's up? Put your hands up. Or just look at him. Or just do a move. This is how really a lot of battles started. You just do a move and stare at the person, like calling him out. Battles could start like that. Who decided the winner would basically be the audience? Now, of course, if a person had more of his friends in the audience, they could make more noise,
right.
You know. But really, battles were pretty fair. Even if a person had all of his boys there, you could tell really who was getting roasted, who was going to win or lose, just by, you know, if someone started repeating their movements. You saw, well, this person's running out of moves. That was grounds to lose right there. Or if someone, you know, some people would battle on a technical level, do a lot of technical, highly complex combinations, right? Another person who maybe wouldn't be as good technically would battle with a clown attitude. He'd try to get the audience to laugh at the person. So a person could be doing all these great combinations, killing themselves. The other guy come up, do a move, do something, make everyone laugh. So there were different ways to get around lack of technique or lack of skill. It was really a personal test. So everything, you had to use your character, your crowd-pleasing abilities, as well as your actual movement. But people will let you know who won. And if you lost the battle, it would be like a loss of face for however long it took you to get your skills back up and go back to that person.
Did you enjoy being in these battles?
Battles were definitely fun, and battles were what made you want to work harder. You know, you see somebody, even if you weren't in a battle, if you were watching a battle, and you saw somebody, and you say, well, you know, I've been practicing for, let's say, you know, 2 months. I haven't been out in a while. I'm coming out to see what's new, what the other brothers are doing in terms of new moves. And you think you have it going on. You think, well, I got my stuff together, and I'm prepared. And you see some guys doing some stuff, and you know that, wow, if that was me, I couldn't handle that. So you have to go back and work harder. So a battle was almost like a midterm, but it could be daily.
Right.
And every time you'd have to, it forced you to be very real with yourself. You have to check yourself. And again, you didn't have to see a battle to know that you had to do more work. You could watch a TV show and just see other dancers or get videos. Now a big thing is people watch videos of dancers from all over the world because, again, it's worldwide. And you see guys in Europe. You see guys, of course, in the West Coast was popping and locking. Incredible. Unbelievable. So you say, man, you know, I still have work to do because you never know enough. You never know it all. And there are people who, like, we have a term in the lab. You might be thinking, well, you know, I'm pretty good at this. But there are people who are in the lab working out hard by themselves. And you have to sometimes go back in that lab and create and come out again fresh.
Now, I know your parents had a dance company. I believe it was like an Afrocentric dance
group. Right. It's called Africa One Dance Theater.
So did you learn African dance before doing hip-hop?
African dance was around me before popping and locking. I would go to the company's rehearsals and sit and watch them. It sort of sunk into me. And I think what African dance showed me and gave me was energy, raw, powerful energy. A lot of my movements are very dynamic, very strong. And I think the energy that I saw in African dance helped me not only in popping and locking, but just in terms of movement. I think it's a great base. And I want to say also my family is very supportive of me getting into popping and into dancing. Anything
Were
positive?
They supportive early on, though, when you started doing it? Did they think it was a legitimate form of dance?
No, they thought it was legitimate. My mother might have thought I was practicing too much. But, you know, I knew that in order to be good, because I knew what guys were doing, and I knew that I had a lot of work to do. She was definitely supportive. And, again, it got to the point, I'd be working on a move, I'd be like, Mom, you know, tell me what you think about this move. You know, I'm doing a wave into a shoot down and a W, and she'd be like, okay, well, that part was good, but that part there, you look like, you know, you didn't extend it fully. So she actually would help me and tell me certain things that she felt I could do more powerfully or, you know, how to make the attack more sharp or things like that.
Run through for me some of the most interesting places that you've danced or some of the most interesting opportunities dance has brought your way.
Okay. There are many. I think the most interesting would be when I was in Africa in a few years back. sometime in the 80s, we went to Abidjan, the Ivory Coast. It was also very interesting to see how far hip-hop dance had reached. Now, of course, it had been in Paris before then and London and all over the world again. But seeing the response we got in Africa, seeing the dancers who were doing unbelievable stuff and not, you know, not saying, well, they were doing African dance and a little bit of popping. No, they were popping and locking, but in ways that you could see their influences, their historical dances. They mixed it, and it was unbelievable.
Do you ever worry about hip-hop and popping being passé, becoming passé?
No, never. And I'll tell you why. I'll try to keep it to 1,000 words or less. You see, when in the 80s, when we had the first resurgence, or the first exposure, I guess you'd say, of the dancing element, the media at some point, and people did say it was passé. That's why you saw it sort of disappear. A lot of people stopped doing it. People who would go, well, I took a hip-hop class today because it was a trendy because it was a trendy thing to do, were now saying, well, no, hip-hop is that's yesterday's thing. It's over. I think it survived that. I think, again, a lot of people did stop, but I feel those people, their hearts really weren't into it, or they had other personal areas they wanted to explore.
Do you or any of the people that you dance with worry about getting too old to keep it up?
No. I think in the course of us doing this show, we do 8 performances a week. And I think it is the most physically demanding show off or on Broadway. And I think if you saw the show and you saw what we do 8 nights a week, I think you'd agree. I think irrespective of age, I mean, there's going to be a definite point when you're not going to be physically able to perform as dynamically, as strongly as we do now. That's just human nature. But I know I will always dance. I mean, I might be 85, but I'll still maybe just throw a wave, you know, just for myself, just to keep that element, that aspect alive.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Adesola Osakalumi, a.k.a. D. Incredible, is dancing in Jam on the Groove, a hip-hop review nearing the end of its off-Broadway run at the Minetta Lane Theater. It will tour in the fall. This is Fresh Air. New York Times columnist William Safire created something of a scandal a few weeks ago when he referred to Hillary Clinton as a congenital liar after missing documents connected to the Whitewater investigation turned up in the private rooms of the White House. To a lot of observers, it seemed a shocking thing to say about the First Lady. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg suggests that Safire's rhetorical excesses are part and parcel of his approach to linguistics.
The thing about William Safire is that he doesn't know when to leave well enough alone. When those Whitewater papers turned up, any critic with his wits about him would have seen that the moment called for wry understatement. But Safire's never been content to lead with his eyebrows. In his Times column of January 8th, he announced that Americans of all political persuasions are coming to the sad realization that our First Lady, a woman of undoubted talents who was a role model for many in her generation, is a congenital liar. The crudeness of the remark gave the president the opportunity to go on the offensive in the role of the aggrieved husband. He let it be known through his press secretary that if he were not the president, he would have punched Safire in the nose. And even commentators who weren't particularly sympathetic to the administration's version of events described Safire's characterization with phrases like vicious, crass, and a gutter attack. But Safire was unrepentant. In a column a few days later, he revealed unsuspected feminist sensibilities, arguing that it would have been sexist to temper his language just because its object happened to be the president's wife. Then he picked up the argument again last week in his Sunday language column. He defended the use of liar, quoting Winston Churchill on the virtues of using short old words. And by way of showing his even-handedness, he pointed out that he'd once said that Nancy Reagan had lied when she denied accepting designer gowns as gifts. But of course, there's a difference between saying that someone lied and saying that she's a liar. They may both be short old words, but only the second is liable to get you punched in the nose. As for the intensifier congenital, Sapphire claimed he was only using the word loosely to mean something like habitual, not in its strict sense to refer to a condition existing from birth. But not even Sapphire can make words mean what he wants them to. When you call somebody a congenital liar, you imply that she lies out of a deep and compulsive trait of character. That might be a fair description of Sapphire's former boss Richard Nixon, but there's no evidence that Hillary Clinton is anything of the sort. In fact, in his original column, Sapphire claimed only that she lied on three specific occasions, and that on each one of these, as he put it, she lied with good reason. Whereas the point about a congenital liar like Nixon is that he lied with no reason at all. He just couldn't help himself. Why did Sapphire use the phrase then? Actually, I suspect that he couldn't help himself either. In the press reactions to the column, people kept stressing Sapphire's reputation as a language expert. As a commentator in The Economist put it, Sapphire, of all people, picks his words carefully. And Sapphire himself claimed in his language column that he'd seized on congenital only after rejecting adjectives like inveterate, chronic, and pathological. That may be true, but picking words carefully isn't always the same thing as picking them well. The fact is that Sapphire has always been a compulsive, or maybe I should say congenital, overwriter. This, after all, is the man who coined Spiro Agnew's phrase, nattering nabobs of negativity, and where's Winston Churchill when you need him? I'm sure he put a lot of thought into that phrase, but it's also clear that accuracy took a backseat to assonance. Sometimes this sort of verbal play lends his writing a buffoonish charm. As Sapphire tells it, for example, Clinton didn't threaten to punch him in the nose. He put my proboscis into pugilistic play. But when he's taking himself seriously, and he takes himself seriously a lot, the instinct for taking things over the top leads to all manner of verbal excess. He throws phrases around like a drunken paper hanger, hoping that somehow they'll stick where they're supposed to. I don't know what was going through his head when he decided to call Mrs. Clinton a congenital liar. Maybe it was just a shock value, or maybe he couldn't resist the echoes of that word genital in there, as if to say, well, whatever. But I have no doubt that he began by picking the phrase and then wrote the rest of the piece around it. I know the problem well. It's the dark side that all us word lovers have to be wary of. I suppose there are worse things than language to be intoxicated by, but in the end, it's like any other dependency. You gotta know when to stop.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.